Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is a progressive pastor, writer, and activist, John Pavlovitz. Pavlovitz is the author of the popular blog Things That Need to Be Said, which reaches millions of readers worldwide, and he's the author of A Bigger Table, Building Messy, Authentic, and Hopeful Spiritual Community, and the forthcoming book, this fall, Hope and Other Superpowers. Pavlovitz began his blog in 2012 while working at a Charlotte, North Carolina megachurch, where he'd served for nearly a decade as a youth pastor. By 2013, he was fired from his position in response to some of his posts he'd written, which the church had deemed too provocative. In 2014, a post he wrote on If I Have Gay Children, Four Promises from a Christian Pastor and Parent, went viral, and following the election of President Trump, his following exploded. Today, he's a youth minister at North Raleigh Community Church in North Carolina and speaks to faith groups around the country. He'll be giving the Harold E. Hill Lecture Saturday night here in Tulsa at 7 o'clock at College Hill Presbyterian Church. And he joins me today on Studio Tulsa. John Pavlovitz, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Wonderful to be with you, Rich. Thank you.
Well, I know a lot of people are looking forward to your lecture in Tulsa Saturday night. Before we talk a little bit about maybe what you're going to talk about this weekend, can you describe your own spiritual journey and how you found your voice? It's sort of a remarkable story.
Well, you know, I grew up in a fairly traditional Italian Roman Catholic family, so I tell people I was raised on gluten and guilt. And I went through kind of the normal journey of faith that many people do. I had a strong sense of God growing up, but a really sort of rigid theology, and began kind of walking away from that as I kind of went into the college years. And I was actually pulled back into the church when I was getting married, and started volunteering there, and was sort of drafted into ministry. It was really a complete surprise, and began kind of working into the church, and spent a few years doing that, and really had some great success, and was working, ended up in a mega church in the South, right in the Bible Belt in Charlotte. And then really began to have sort of a deconstruction of my faith and a shift in my beliefs in the middle of that. And it's really been a process for the past, 10 years, especially, of trying to figure out what that faith journey looks like now.
Now, and so you mentioned you started out as a Catholic, so you had a very formal conservative church upbringing, and then you went into this more evangelical, I would assume, this mega church and Baptist seminary would be evangelical model.
Yeah, for me it was walking into a completely foreign world in a lot of ways, and in a world that I never quite felt totally in sync with, because a lot of the people that I was ministering alongside had been on this path for their whole lives and had a language that they spoke and a certain sense of sensibilities, and I just kind of always felt a little bit outside of that, and so was always in ministry kind of pushing or nudging our community to a place of maybe deeper inclusion or greater diversity, and was surprised when resistance to that actually came.
They basically asked you to resign at some point because you were writing by that point, and I assume urging a more inclusive evangelical outlook?
Right. Yeah. The blog evolved, gradually. It was really started in my time in Charlotte as just an insider for our large church community, just writing to parents of teenagers and maybe to youth pastors and just very. But then the blog began to slowly reach outside of our local community. And the more that happened, the more responsibility I felt to speak explicitly into matters of whether it's race or sexuality, or political things. And as I did that, the audience grew, but that created a tension in the communities where I served, because it was just butted up against a lot of things that were already fully entrenched there. And I completely get it looking back, because I know what I thought about people like me when I was in those places, but it was just, it couldn't last very long.
Was it an evolution in your own thinking and belief system, or was it more you were always pushing the envelope while you were in that system?
It was really once I started to tap into the things, the theological questions that I was having, or the, you know, I was hearing the stories of oppressed, marginalized groups, and they were telling me that the church was damaging them. The more stories I began to hear, the more those stories began to sort of work in me. And then speaking out wasn't really an agenda. It's just the logical byproduct of being exposed to that diversity. And so there was really, it was, for years, it really worked well for me being in that setting until it didn't work well for me. And at that point, you just begin speaking truth because that's your job as a minister of any kind, is to take the deepest convictions you have and to speak those, which can be a liability.
How important is it for the Christian church, and I say the Christian church encompassing a huge range of denominations and faiths and creeds, to have this bigger table that you write of being more inclusive, of basically rejecting no one who believes in the central tenets of Christianity?
Well, I think, you know, with the world getting so much smaller, people are aware of the what's happening in the church. They're aware of the theology of the church. You know, back when I was growing up, you had a minister or a priest, in my case, and they would tell you what God said and what it meant, and that was it. But now people understand theology. They understand how the Bible is used and misused. And it's more important than ever that people of faith, regardless of their faith tradition, try to find the most authentic, most loving expression of their tradition and to live that as loudly as they can. And so for the church, when we say the big church, really we're talking about individual faith communities. Local churches need to figure out what kind of voice are we going to perpetuate in the world, and we need to be unapologetic about that. And so there are a lot of churches being really loud right now in a really dangerous theology, and I think what I'm trying to do is be a differing voice in people's heads of the Christian faith.
You know, I was reading one review of your work and your writing, and it said you are a red-letter defender of Jesus' teachings. Of course, that goes back to a lot of Bibles where the actual words of Jesus in the Gospels are written in red. You know, it's about embracing those in poverty, embracing those who are different from the majority. It's about embracing the stranger. It's about really, in what in many ways is a hard row to hoe.
I think what's happened is over decades in this country, there is a version of Christianity that began to take root, and it little by little began to abandon really the central core teachings of Jesus. And so if you look at the life and the ministry of Jesus, and you took any sort of history or politics out of it, you would see the purity of it. And I think what's happened is so many people have been raised in a counterfeit version of that they no longer see it. And so when I try to do is hold up the words in the life of Jesus as a mirror to the church and say, do these things resemble one another? And if they don't, we have to face why that is.
Now, you mentioned politics. It's interesting that you are very much engaged in politics in your own way. I've been called the pastor of the resistance. Your blog, Stuff That Needs to Be Said, is regularly encountering what has happened in our current events. Was that a big change for you?
It certainly was. You know, if I can look back, and I had never written anything about a particular individual politician. I've never named one in the writing, never talked about political parties. But what began to happen over the course of the election season and then the election itself and now the presidency, I think people of faith have an obligation to speak into these moments, and they are invariably going to butt up against legislation or political positions. It's just the nature of life. And for Jesus, he's always, you know, rubbing up against those things and coming into extreme turbulence because of what he was living for and fighting for. And it's no different now. And so I don't look at these things as political as much as they're just human things. This is me expressing the deepest, you know, faith that I have. And then living with however that looks to someone on the outside, they can label it political or not. But for me, it's human stuff.
Let me ask you, was that a difficult decision for you to make, to begin addressing political issues as opposed to more church-related issues of inclusion, of loving the other, or, you know, the typical agenda of a progressive Christian pastor?
In some ways, it's difficult. I think progressive Christianity or progressive faith traditions, by their nature, are a little bit gentler, a little bit more tolerant of different views, and so they tend not to be really demonstrative, and sometimes that is to our detriment. And so the challenge is how to speak about these things in a way that keeps that inclusion central, but really doesn't shy away from bold declaration. Because what you'll see on one side of theology is this really fervent, passionate thing. It's leveraging fear, it's leveraging damnation, whatever it's using. And the challenge for progressive faith is to say, I'm going to be unapologetic about the things that I believe, and I'm going to express that faith in a way that is unusual, perhaps, to some ears. So, yeah, you're talking about love for the other, but you're also talking about Jesus telling people to, you know, when you love the least, you love him. And so it's using all these things that we're facing right now and putting them up and really not shying away from the reality.
I was struck by one of your recent blog posts, which addressed the people who were seeing in the background at these rallies that President Trump has been having, especially over the course of the summer. And it was pretty harsh writing about the people who are following them. And I guess the question I want to ask has to do more with how a lot of the churches in your part of the country, certainly in our part of the country as well, have certainly embraced this president in a way in which they've never embraced any other leader, conservative, middle of the road, or liberal, ever before. What's your reaction to that?
Well, there's a sadness there when you see what the heart of the gospel is, right? And, you know, Billy Sunday, he was quoted one time as saying, if you have no joy, there's a leak in your Christianity somewhere. And that's what I lament. It's the fact that there are people who are claiming the Christian faith, and yet their theology and their politics seem to be so filled with cruelty and anger and the close-fisted thing. And so there's really a lot of reasons for this. You can explain how, you know, how this has happened, but the reality of it is we've arrived here, that someone can have a faith that is called Christian but is pretty much devoid of the life of Jesus. And so the question is, can we get back? Can Christianity be helpful again? Can we redeem that faith? And that's what we're, you know, a lot of us are trying to do.
I think you wrote of something of this sense of oppression that seems to be a part of them, that they really can't put a finger to what's exactly oppressing them, or this feeling of oppression.
Yeah, there's the lie that you get told by politics or by preachers is that you're always in danger, or that you're always under attack. Or you're always being maligned. And when you begin to hear that enough times, you begin to believe it. And then, so even if you are the beneficiary of so many things about this country that are wonderful, you can still feel yourself oppressed. So right now, you know, a large group of you know, white people are feeling somehow marginalized. And that's a really strange tension to be living in. It's a very oxymoronic moment.
My guest today is John Pavlovitz. He is a writer and pastor, a pastor at North Raleigh Community Church in North Carolina. He's the author of A Bigger Table, Building Messy, Authentic, and Hopeful Spiritual Communities, and the blog, Stuff That Need to Be Said. And he'll be the lecturer for the Harold E. Hill Lecture Saturday night at 7 at College Hill Presbyterian Church at 7th and Columbia here in Midtown Tulsa. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, I want to mention a couple other blog posts that you've written recently. One was an open letter to those that still give a damn. And it goes to a lot of people who are following the news closely and perhaps even turning the radio, turning the television off, turning off the blog, because it's so exhausting to follow everything that's happening each day. What was your advice to those that are getting exhausted by what's happening in the country and in the news cycles each day?
Well, I think part of, you know, our access to information is so great now that we get the news, but we also get an exaggerated version of it. It begins to be artificially multiplied in our head because we see people sharing it over and over again. And so part of the challenge is to know what's happening, to be educated, but to not have an artificially inflated version of it. And a lot of people are just exhausted by the relentlessness and the volume of bad news. So part of my job, and when I show up in different communities, people come and I can see the exhaustion on their faces. And so I try to remind them that they're not alone, they're not losing their minds, and that there are things that they can do to begin to change things ever so slightly. And it's not about, you know, saving the world. It's about changing that place that you're standing on right now. And so I just try to offer some encouragement to people to keep those muscles of compassion working, you know, hold on to that empathy, because that does make you different right now to a lot of what's happening in our country, and it's valuable.
Now, one of the things you're doing right now is speaking around the country, but when you're working in your own community, what are the things you're doing to lower your blood pressure to make a difference in Raleigh?
Yeah, part of it is there is where a lot of us are tied to our screens, and there is a danger in that, because that world that we create, as I said, it can be completely artificial and you can talk yourself into despondency. And so every day I try to get out into the world, and obviously I'm trying to get out into nature and getting those moments of rest to kind of recalibrate, but I'm also trying to get around people. And when you're around people, you see that they're beautiful and that they're diverse and that there's, you know, there are wonderful things happening in every corner of this country. And you need to let some of that good news sort of dominate your thoughts. And so as you get out into the world and you do work in the community, you just see that life is still happening, sometimes defiantly so.
One of the things you've been writing about a lot of in recent weeks has been just the incredible news that has been coming out from this administration, a child separation policy that's separating families along the border, really separating families all over the country now. How are you trying to address that in your everyday life?
Well, the only thing that we can do when we see senseless things happening, especially as a person of faith, when I see something happening that feels like a perversion of that faith tradition, my responsibility is to live my version of that faith as explicitly as I can. And so, you know, the writing helps me because it does help me speak into this kind of conversation, but it's also in the small things. I'm trying to speak as often as I can so that as many people hear it. You know, family conversations are difficult right now, and friendships are strained, and marriages are feeling the tension. But I tell people that they still have a responsibility to keep affirming life in all of those, you know, relationships, because it's going to take root at certain people at certain times. But when you see a disconnect like the family separation policy, you almost can't bridge that disconnect if people can't see it.
I was struck by something you wrote about maybe within the last month or two, and it's about that idea that families are alienating, communities that have been close are alienating over the current events of this country. Is that surprising to you?
I think what has been surprising is the speed at which things have devolved and the relationships that have unraveled, and really surprised that they sort of unraveled around this kind of one human being who a couple of years ago would have been a footnote. And I think that's the alarming part about it, is that people have dug into positions now to the degree that they have relationships that are never going to be the same. And as I travel around the country, that's sort of the recurring theme. I do pastoral care online for people. That invariably is the story, that people are not just facing these political realities, the systemic things in our country, but they're facing the individual sort of collateral damage of the relationships that are the fabric of really what it means to really be a human being here. And that's some of that is irreparable, and it's sad.
So this is something you encounter when you're pastoring, that families are splitting apart over the politics of the day?
Oh, without question. And I think a lot of it, you know, because of the forum that I offer, the writing is sort of a hub around which people gather from all over the country. And so they find affinity there. They begin to share stories and build relationships. And often through the Facebook group or other groups that I'm a part of, people are saying, you know, where I am right now, it's really difficult. Either geographically, there's no one around me, or there's great emotional distance around me. And so they're trying to find places where they can feel fully authentic. And so it's I think that's the greatest casualty of this current administration. There is legislation that's horrible, and there are all sorts of things that are being done to the country, you know, constitutionally. But I think the interpersonal stuff is also just incredibly invasive.
Do you think that goes away when things change, or do you think that's long-term damage?
I think the mistake would be to think that this was about one person or one politician. It's really all that election has been is an uncovering. And I think, so regardless of what happens in the midterms or in 2020 or beyond, we are going to have to kind of now reckon with this version of America that we've now seen. A lot of it, you know, people of color and the LGBTQ community and marginalized communities have known the reality of this America, but I think more of us now are seeing it. And now it's a question of what we do going forward. It's not going to disappear. These things are going to be there, and we have to address them.
Can you maybe describe more of this uncovering? Was it just the fact that the election of this president allowed people to come out with viewpoints that they felt like were now something that could be discussed openly?
I think when you have a personality who really, that's what the campaign was. It was about a certain style, a personality style. And when that begins to take root, when recklessness and kind of saying anything becomes presidential, well, then people say, well, now I have license to say things that maybe for the sake of decorum I would have kept hidden. So in some ways it's a kind of a gift to us to really, because people are now showing who they are, where before they may have couched those things. So I think that's what it is. The uncovering has been people who once said, I can't say this, now say, oh, I'm going to say it. They feel emboldened. And so that comes with it all sorts of conflict, but it also helps people see what we're dealing with.
Getting back to your book titles, the new one and the past one, Building Messy, Authentic, Hopeful Spiritual Communities, isn't it hopeful that this is now out in the open as opposed to hidden? In a way. In the fact that you can talk and you can have dialogue about this, about race, about the status of what our country is. Is it truly a melting pot of all sorts of people? Is it, you know, all these issues that have been coming out?
Right. I think that there is an upside to it. It's very difficult for me as a cisgender, heterosexual, white Christian guy to say, oh, this is great that we know all this because there are families who are living in great duress right now because of this presidency. However, what it has done is it awakened millions of people who are now politically active and who are becoming activists in all sorts of ways. And so it is a moment where I think we can walk into the best version of our country. We can say, yeah, these are myths that we grew up on, the myth of our shared coexistence and our diverse, you know, gathering, and we can actually say, but if we want that to be true, then we can move forward. So that's where the hope is. The hope is saying, yeah, I'm looking at these young teenage activists, and I'm looking at grandmothers who are getting into the political process and leveraging their social media profiles, even getting social media profiles just to do that. I mean, that there's a lot of goodness to be found.
My guest today is John Pavlovitz. He's a writer and pastor at North Raleigh Community Church in North Carolina, the author of A Bigger Table, Building Messy, Authentic, and Hopeful Spiritual Community, and the blog Stuff That Needs to Be Said. And he also has a forthcoming book this fall titled Hope and Other Superpowers. He'll be the lecturer for the Harold E. Hill Lecture at College Hill Presbyterian Church Saturday evening at 7 o'clock. We'll talk a little bit about your next book, Hope and Other Superpowers. And it sounds like the last book was a sort of a combination of this idea of building a larger church and your own story. What is this book about?
Well, not long after the election, someone was talking to me about the world, and she said, I just don't know if people know how to be decent human beings anymore. And I reminded her that, yeah, they do, but maybe it's not those elemental things we don't really talk about anymore. So I started thinking about her, and I started thinking about a book for her and for people like her who are really just kind of grieving what they're seeing in the world and frustrated and wanting to find some encouragement. And so the question at the heart of the book is, what kind of person does the world need? And if I asked a group of people that, you know, regardless of their theological, you know, perspective or political persuasion or their life stage or nation of origin, there'd be a lot of commonality in what we believe the world needs, what kind of people. And so the book is about, let's talk about those things, generosity and compassion and humility and honesty, and let's try to lean into those individually, and then let's get into community and try to live those out and see if we can't do something productive in this time in the history of the planet. You know, sadly, my experience has been theology, doctrine tends to be part of the barrier because we're looking for those litmus tests that we can put people in and out of our gatherings, and that tribalism is so strong. And so, yeah, for me, it's trying to find a place where we can just meet at our shared humanity and then begin to say, all right, let's figure out how this could look without the labels of political party, without the labels of religious tradition, which is a challenge because we've grown up identifying with those things, and it's hard for us now to meet people simply as human beings.
A lot of people look at the tribalism that's evolved, and it goes beyond political beliefs. It goes to spiritual beliefs. It goes to a whole cultural beliefs, everything along the lines, that those are really hard to transcend and maybe can't be transcended. What are your thoughts and what are your reaction to people say, this is who people are. They've always been tribal. They always will be tribal.
I think that's true, but I think part of it is maybe redefining what a tribe could look like. And you know, for me, that's what the church, what the bigger table was about, was saying, hey, look, you can meet at this place and we can create spiritual community that doesn't require you to go elsewhere. And that's really, I think it's redefining what it means to belong and what you're belonging to, and to kind of redraw those lines, not around border, not around national identity. And so that's the hope. The hope is you can get a group of, I tell people, we don't have to be like-minded, but we can be like-hearted in that we value a life and we want to live in a way that does no harm as much as we can do that.
I want to ask you one last question that has to do with what gives you hope these days?
I think there are a million reasons to have hope. I think it's just what you choose to dwell on. And so I try to take those stories, you know, the book is filled with them. People just saying, I see a lack of compassion in the world. I'm going to try to fill that gap. I see a lack of kindness, so I'm going to do something to that effect. And I just try to take those stories and to kind of post-it note them in my mind so that they're always there. And I think that's the lesson here. We all have to, we can get up every day and look for despair or reason for hope, and we just have to kind of remind ourselves that there's still reason for hope there.
All right. John Pavlovitz, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
Progressive Christian pastor, writer, and activist John Pavlovitz speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He is the author of the blog Stuff That Needs to Be Said and the book from last year, A Bigger Table, Building Messy, Authentic, and Hopeful Spiritual Community. He'll be the lecturer for the Harold E. Hill Lecture at College Hill Presbyterian Church Saturday evening at 7. For more information on his writings and his blog, visit johnpavlovitz.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.